All right, guys, so we are in 1 Samuel chapter 3, and here's what we're hoping to achieve this evening. We're hoping to make it through 1 Samuel 3, and then the first 10 verses of 1 Samuel 4, and then I'm going to do a slight detour and just talk about the Ark of the Covenant for a minute, and hopefully point some interesting things out there for us as well. So thus far in 1 Samuel, we've seen Eli and his house, bad. All right, we got that part. We've seen Elkanah and his house, other than Penina, good, right? You have the kind of the antagonist there with the wife. We have these contrasts between these two houses as we're all the way through this point. We saw that a prophet had to come and tell Eli that his house and his line would die, and they would not just die, they would die violently. They would die by the sword. It's just not going to be a fun road out for his line. And then we saw that Samuel was growing in stature and in favor with Yahweh and man, very much echoing how Jesus is described in Luke, growing in wisdom, stature and wisdom, and favor with God and man. So we kind of end with that, and we're going to pick up with 3, and look at me at verses 1 through 2. Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no frequent vision. At that time, Eli, whose eyesight had begun to grow dim so that he could not see, was lying down in his own place. All right, so again, you have this contrast. Samuel, still a boy, ministering to Yahweh in Eli's presence, so before Eli and his oversight, and the word of the Lord is rare in those days. And what we're witnessing with the birth of Samuel and kind of the rise of Samuel is a transition, right? There's a transition from the way that Yahweh would reveal his will. So typically, you would see it in the priestly line. This was the high priest. This is the one who went before the Lord, the one who mediated on behalf of the people before the Lord. And this high priest can no longer hear the word of Yahweh. He has hardened his heart. He has despised his position as someone who should oversee his sons and their blasphemy that they do. And so you're seeing the shift from priestly authority to prophetic authority, right? The prophets are going to be the ones who begin to come in with the authority for Israel and the correctives and all those kinds of things. And so we see as well that Eli is blind or very close to blind, and it's probably meant to illustrate not just physical blindness, right? He's that, but also his spiritual blindness, right? You're seeing that Eli is not only getting old, but he's lost his spiritual edge, if you would. He can't see Yahweh's visions, right? Yahweh doesn't appear to him. He has to send a prophet to come condemn him down the road. He doesn't even appear to Eli. And then he's going to talk to Samuel, and we'll realize that Eli can't hear the voice either. So Eli is deaf and dumb to the will of the Lord outside of someone else, which is a lot of great condemnation on Israel. It's Israel being led by the blind. That's bad, all right? So as blind Eli lies on his couch, look at verse 3. The lamp of God had not gone out yet, and Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. So this is probably late in the night or early in the morning. As Eli lies on his couch in darkness, Samuel lies in the light of the Lord. It's contrast you have between the two. And it's important that it makes the point that the light had not yet gone out. And so practically, you're probably looking at like 4 in the morning, like really before it would start to go out the night, and part of Samuel's job was to get up and stoke it back up and get it lit again for the next day's work, right? So, but it had not yet gone out, but it's getting late. But again, you have Eli in darkness, you have Samuel by the light of Yahweh, right? And I think too, it points, the word of the Lord is rare, but the fire of the Lord is still present, right? So it's all hope is not lost, right? That's kind of what's being communicated in the imagery here. It's masterful storytelling. It really is great. Then 4 through 7. And the Lord called Samuel, and he said, "Here I am." And he ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." But Eli said, "I did not call. Lie down again." So he went and lay down. And the Lord called again Samuel. And Samuel arose, went to Eli, and said, "Here I am, for you called me." But he said, "I did not call, my son. Lie down again." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, and the word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. So twice Samuel hears the voice of Yahweh. He doesn't recognize it. He thinks it's Eli calling him, and he runs to talk to Eli. And we get an interesting glimpse into Eli and Samuel's relationship here. So Eli's sons have been cut off, right? They're wicked sons. They're rebellious. They are really the next iteration of Nadab and Abihu. You're seeing these pairs of unfaithful sons of high priest, right? The next iteration of Nadab and Abihu. Yet here is faithful Samuel, the son of what was then a barren mother, right, who could not have children, a woman. He is faithfully serving the Lord before in the presence of Eli, and Eli calls him my son, which is a term of endearment. It's very much so when Eli says my son, it's very much you're seeing a loving relationship between the two that has kind of developed there. And look, I think that's something to Eli's credit, because what Eli could have done was despised, you know, the Joseph in his midst, right? The faithful son, because his own sons can't get their act together. You can see a threatening thing, a contrast going on, but he didn't allow Samuel's faithfulness to cause bitterness or to cause resentment. Maybe he assumed that Samuel would be the one who the faithful house of Yahweh would be built around. Remember, he says, I'm going to give it to someone else. Maybe Eli assumed this was who it would be. And so he's, you know, has no problem. He's going to in good relationship there. Maybe he really never thought of Samuel's competition at all. We don't really know, but what we do know is they seem to have actually a very good relationship between the two of them. And we get this in verse 7. Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, and the word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. Question is, what does that mean? Right? Because you really have two options. The first is you could say that this is simply referring to Yahweh having not yet spoken. So Samuel had not yet had an interaction with Yahweh, and so we didn't know his voice, right, in that kind of context. That's probably the majority view. I don't know. The commentaries I went through were pretty split on it, but I think that's probably maybe the plainest reading. But there is a second possibility. If you look at 2 Samuel 2:12, now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. And so you kind of get this, Hophni and Phinehas do not know the Lord. Samuel does not yet know the Lord. It's the same word for knowing. It's a yada, right? The same word. So you could probably take it either way. You can take it either way and be fine, right? So if this is the first time Yahweh speaks to him, great. That's perfectly fine to take. But I do think if you see it as Samuel not yet having put his faith, he's still a young boy. He's still a young boy at this point. And so you could make the argument that Samuel has not yet trusted Yahweh. He's serving in the temple. Who are his mentors? Not very godly men, right? But he's doing his duty as he's supposed to do it, right? And like I said, he's 6, 8, maybe 10, but we know he's not considered a man. He's still a young boy. And then in verse 19, we kind of see him having grown up. And if you know you have kids, faith, anywhere in that age, you can begin to see that realization in their head and that kind of that light click. But I think it says something if you take the view that Samuel's not saved yet. Because we have this idea of Abraham follows the call, but it's not till Abraham believes that it's credited as righteousness, right? So there is a sense that you can obey the Lord, you can do the right things, yet not have faith, right? We understand this in life. But I think it speaks to raising our children well, right? There's a sense that, you know, one of the detriments to children's church is that we ship all the kids out and assume they can't understand what's going on until they're in fifth grade. There's something to be said to raising them in the house of the Lord, right? Constantly hearing it. They may not understand it. They may not have processed through it, but they learn how to serve. They learn how to be part of the kingdom, right? And so I think there's a strong argument for that. I think it's important to also note the word for ministering is simply to serve. that's the word. Like, it's used different ways, but ministering for the Lord is serving before the Lord. He's doing temple duties. It doesn't necessarily carry a faithful piety, like a faith piety with it. It just means he's doing his duty in the temple. In the temple. Any thoughts on that? Yeah. That's right. Yeah. It's all easy to, Judas is like the easy guy to pick on, right? Like, Judas is there for all of it. Didn't have faith, right? I mean, you can see this with a lot of these guys. It's a good point. Yeah. I tend to lean toward Samuel is serving because this is what he is to do. And he understands this is what I am to do, but I don't know if he has faith until the Lord speaks and he begins to see these things come through. I tend to lean that way. But again, I don't think it changes. It doesn't change the arc of the story, whichever side you fall on it. So that's good. All right, so let's go through 8 through 9. And the Lord called Samuel again the third time. And he arose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you who called me." Then Eli perceived that the Lord was calling the boy. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, "Go, lay down. If he calls you, you shall say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant hears.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. And the Lord came and stood, calling as at other times, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant hears." So Eli figures it out. The word for perceives is just he understood. Eli understood. It doesn't show, I don't think, you know, the perceives communicates maybe that he's got some sharp insight he picked up on. It just is kind of like after this many times, Eli has just kind of processed, okay, something's happening in the temple, right? And so it's probably the Lord. You're sleeping before his fire. You say, "Speak, your servant hears." And that, of course, your servant shemaz is the word there, like the Shema. Yeah. It's a great question, right? And again, I think it shows the state of Eli's soul, I think. And maybe, look, it could testify to Eli's reverence. I mean, like, I believe that people cannot be Christians and have a deep fear of God. And I think Eli is a person who tends to portray someone who does not have zeal for the Lord, but understands the Lord is a real thing, a real entity. And so he's already been rebuked, he's been condemned, and maybe in his mind, it's too late. And I think we actually kind of get that later on. I think the way he responds to Samuel when he tells him what the Lord said, I think it just kind of comes across like, he's the Lord, he's going to do what he's going to do. Like there's kind of this resignation. And so maybe for Eli at this point, he's just resigned. He's just, you know, in despair. Would make a lot of sense to me. But that's a good question. But again, I think it speaks to the state of his soul, his relationship with the Lord. He doesn't want to be in the presence. Yeah. It's good. Good question. Verse 10, and the Lord came and stood. Oh, I did that. Sorry. Let's see. Oh, yeah. So it says the Lord came and stood. Right, so we don't have that standing the other times, but he stood as at other times, calling at us other times, and it's interesting. So we don't know what the presence looks like, how God manifests himself there. You could argue it's the angel of the Lord, which we tend to see as when the manifestation of the second person of Trinity shows up. But also the way the Lord, you know, he's pillar fire, a pillar of cloud, however you say it. He, in a temple, he's going to be a dense cloud, right? I mean, so it could be a cloud. It could be any of those ways that we've understood theophany and how he appears. We're just not told, but there is something that seems to be physically present as he is standing there with Samuel that is interesting. And Samuel replies. He says exactly what Eli says, but he leaves something out. He leaves out Yahweh, right? He says, "Speak, your servant listens." Whereas Eli said, "Say, speak, Yahweh, your servant listens. And Samuel leaves this part out. And it simply could be scribal omission, right? It just somehow got worked out over the years. But I think it leads maybe some credence to the idea that Samuel doesn't quite understand what's going on. He's still pretty young, and he might not understand. He didn't know Yahweh. He doesn't quite assume it's Yahweh. So when there's his appearance, he doesn't recognize him as such. I mean, and Moses does a similar thing at the burning bush. Like, he sees it, and the angel of the Lord comes out. Well, who am I going to tell them sent me? It's Yahweh. And you kind of have this not an immediate recognition that this is my God, but you know it's a God. It's something, right? And so, but for whatever reason, Samuel leaves the Yahweh part out. And maybe it's for rhetorical flair, as we'll see in a minute here. We'll see. You ever heard the Bible is rhetorical flair, right? I don't get that a whole lot. Look at 11 through 14. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Behold, I'm about to do a thing in Israel at which the two ears of everyone who hears it will tingle." Like, tremble is a good word for that too. "On that day, I will fulfill against Eli all that I've spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. And I declare to him that I am about to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew, because his sons were blaspheming God, and he did not restrain them." So there's his judgment, not dealing with his sons. "Therefore, I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." So the idea is that their end is coming. We tell Samuel, the end is coming. Right? And although you have this, the wickedness of Eli and his sons in view, it's not just Eli and his sons that are going to suffer through this. All of Israel is going to suffer. I mean, when the high priest goes down, you have problems. You know, Day of Atonement, these kind, like when you find out you have a corrupt priesthood, you have problems. All of Israel is going to struggle. War has consequences, and there will be war. And when the prophet told Eli in the last chapter, he said, "Your sons are going to die by the sword. This is how this goes. You're going to die by the sword. It's not going to be fun." And this idea, you know, the high priest at this point was kind of, unless God raised up a judge to do something, the high priest was the final kind of judge at this point in Israel's kind of government and structure and system. And so you have this point where the judge of Israel, God is coming down to judge the judge of Israel. Your leadership is corrupt, right? It's not good. And that would cause the ears of all who hear it to tremble, right? This is to tremor is a good synonym there. So let's look, keep going, 15 through 18. "Samuel lay until morning. Then he opened the doors of the house of the Lord, and Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. But Eli called Samuel and says, 'Samuel, my son.' He said, 'Here I am.' And Eli said, 'What was it that he told you? Do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more also, if you hide anything from me of all that he told you.' So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And he said, 'It is the Lord.'" This is Eli. "It is Yahweh. Let him do what seems good to him." So Samuel's rightfully scared. I mean, it seems like they have a good relationship, and this is very difficult news to tell Eli, right? And so he's rightfully scared. And it's, you know, Eli asks him first. And the first request, you know, it doesn't show up in the text, but it should have, "Tell me what the vision was, please." Like it's kind of gnaw on is what it's called. And it's a way of like a requesting politely something. So he, "Please tell me what the vision said." And Samuel's like, not a conversation I'm looking forward to, right? And so after, and who knows how long he went without telling him. We don't know if it's immediate, if it's days. And finally, Eli comes back and says, "All the curses of that come upon you if you don't tell me." Comes in with the strong hammer, right? And so Samuel tells him. And Eli just seems resigned. It's Yahweh. Let him do what's good to him. Again, I think what we get from Eli is just resignation for the most part. He seems to be a whipped puppy with no attempt to really try to reconcile, to beg for mercy, to step in and do something about his sons, to try to stem the wrath. He just kind of lets it go, you know. But in that statement, Eli does something else. Eli affirms that it's Yahweh that speaks to Samuel. Because Samuel doesn't call him Yahweh. He doesn't introduce himself as Yahweh. And it's at this point, because Eli knows the prophecy. He knows what he was told by the prophet before. And when Samuel comes in and repeats the prophecy, this is what this figure told me. He says, it's the Lord. Because he knows. And so you get the affirmation for Samuel of who's appearing before him. It's Yahweh. And Eli even knows that it's the voice of Yahweh. And it's interesting because Samuel, as much as we like Samuel, like he's like one of the guys that were like, he's a good one. You know, he just kind of tends to do things right. Samuel's ministry in a lot of ways, he's a prophet of doom. He really is. If you think about Samuel, so he's going to have this vision where he has to tell the high priest judgment's coming on Israel and the priestly line to wipe it out. He's going to condemn Israel for wanting a king. They want a king like all the nations. He's going to fight them on it and tell them that you're going to get it and you're going to hate it, right? This is your king will run your men before you to war, your sons. This is what's going to happen. Tells them how bad it's going to be. Saul sins. He comes and condemns Saul. He says the line's been cut off. He's going to anoint a rival that will incite a civil war in Israel, David. All right? In his death, he's going to come up and condemn Saul, right? I mean, like, Samuel's ministry in a lot of ways is being the guy that has to say all the difficult things. He's the guy who's got to come, and he gets to do some wonderful things too, but he really serves. And look, in a lot of ways, this is, again, he foreshadows John the Baptist in a lot of ways. John the Baptist saying, the kingdom is coming. The judgment is coming. Repent. Cleanse yourself. Herod, what are you doing? Right? I mean, he's having to do this thing in a lot of ways. It's very, very similar. It's not the frilly fun stuff, you know. It's difficult. So I think our view of Samuel is pretty bright and sunny. Samuel's a good guy. We like him. But if you look at the story as we get through it, you'll see Samuel has to do a lot of difficult things. He's very much a herald of doom for most of his time as a prophet of Israel. So, and even when he does the fun things, he doesn't get to talk about it. He's going to anoint David as king, and he has to kind of do it in secret. He doesn't get this opportunity to celebrate this big triumph. A lot of what he does is behind the scenes. When he anoints Saul, it's behind the scenes. He just doesn't eventually have the ceremony as the first king, but it's. Any thoughts up to this point? Let's go 19 through 21. Hold on, Mom. Uh-oh. Back there, Colin. Is it switching? No. One second. Let me try to pull this back up. It lagged up on me. Yep, I lost it. Okay, Colin, I need you to run it for me. 3:19 through 4:1. And Samuel grew in the Lord and was with him and let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Yahweh at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. And the word of Samuel came, which is first part of one, and the word of Samuel came to all of Israel. That's 4:1 right there. So the first part of chapter 4, actually, is do we have that up there, Colin? Yeah. So one right before that. This should be the slide with text before that. That's it. Okay, so that, in your Bibles, it breaks and starts with that. So I have to remember, it's about 500 years after Jesus that we put verse numbers and headings and chapter titles and all the text, right? Most commentators say this is the end of chapter 3. Samuel has been, the Lord has appeared to him again at Shiloh, and the word of Samuel came to all of Israel. And you have to ask the question, what is the word of Samuel that came to all of Israel? And I think the immediate context is the doom of the house of Eli. the incoming judgment. Because remember, it says, all the ears, every ear that hears is going to tingle. Well, that's a weird thing to say if other ears weren't going to hear. If this was a private thing between them, so the nation will hear that this judgment is coming, and it will not be good. It will cause dread. And so I think after the second visit, I think it says he grows in wisdom there in 19. I think Samuel's come into his manhood, his adulthood, and now can officially fulfill this role as a prophet of the Lord, right? So the Lord reappears to him, kind of now commissioning him as a prophet, and then he begins to prophesy for the Lord, and that's probably one of the first ones is the judgment coming upon the house of Eli. And you get no response, it's interesting, from Israel. Like, there's no lament. There's no sadness for Eli. You might be able to argue that the response is, well, let's, you know, remember when Israel went into the promised land and then they flaked out, like the first time around, and they flaked out on it, and then Moses said, desert. And they said, no, we'll go to war now. And they go in, and he's like, don't do it. And they go, and they just get ransacked. Remember that? We could be getting another version of this. We could be getting a version of judgment's coming, and they go, we're supposed to drive these nations out, weren't we? Let's go to war. Right, and they're going in like to try to get God's favor back on. It feels like there's something like that because they're going to bring the ark into play. It's just kind of an odd thing to just suddenly be at war with no king. And Israel instigates the war. We find out Israel has marched out to war, and the Philistines comes out to meet them. So it seems like potentially this is a response to the prophecy, and Israel said, "No, we'll get it right this time." And they're trying to do the same thing they've done in the past. But I cannot prove that. So just that's my two cents on it. Let's pick up in 4:1. It's the second 4:1, Colin. It'll be starting in B after that first little line. Go ahead and throw it up there for me. Make sure we got the right one. There we go. Yeah. All right. So now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. They encamped, this is 1-3, at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. And when the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines?" Right? Why did he do this? It's like, stop hitting yourself, right? Like, let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that we may come, that he may come among us. The Hebrew it can also be he, that he may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies. So Israel marches to war. The text indicates that they instigate it. The Philistines come out and slaughter them. And every elder just says, why didn't Yahweh come with us? Let's get the ark, right? Let's bring that sucker out. And we can bring him among us, right? This is how this is going to work. And Israel makes a terrible mistake. And we talked about this in the past. But the terrible mistake that Israel makes is they try to weaponize the sign of the covenant. Right, you have this ark, you have this mercy seat, and we're going to talk about the ark in a minute, but Levi and Simeon do the same thing, circumcision, and they go and wipe the tribe out. They're weaponizing God's mercy, his gifts, his things that point to the covenant that he has with his people. You don't turn those things into weapons. Now, if Yahweh wants to march out, he can, but you don't get to weaponize him. Right, you see how that works? And so they're going to try to weaponize the Ark of the Covenant to try to militarize Yahweh on their terms. And it's an ignorant task, right? The Ark is called the mercy seat, and they try to make it a seat of war. Verse 4, so the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who's enthroned on the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there at the Ark of the covenant of the Lord. So who brings out the ark? The two condemned men, right, with all their problems, marching it out of there. It's a bleak foreboding, 5-9. As soon as the ark of the covenant came to the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, what is this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrew men? They just killed 4,000 men. Why are they shouting? And when they learned the ark of the Lord had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. For they said, a god has come into the camp. And they said, woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck Egypt with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight. It's a pretty good speech. When you think the enemy just brought gods onto the playing field and you're like, man up, like So, a few things to note. One is the Ark has the legend behind it. They know of this thing. This is what struck the Egyptians, right? They know this thing has its reputation goes out before it, right? And they go, they brought their God with them. This is not good. Now, there's a great irony. Can you bring God with you in a box? Not a good one, right? I mean, not a good God, right? Maybe a God, not the one you want. God doesn't live in the ark, right? The ark is his footstool, in a sense. It's the seat, right? He's in the heavens. He's not contained. The Philistines rally. They come to the fight. And in verse 10, so the Philistines fought. And Israel was defeated, and they fled, every man to his home. And there was a very great slaughter, for 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel fell. So Israel is just routed terribly. Absolutely. And again, it feels a lot like when they first try to go in the promised land and try to do it after Yahweh said not to. It feels like you're seeing a kind of a duplication of the same kinds of things. And Israel is notorious for the same cycles of things too, right? We are too. We do our same sins and our same struggles and same bargains and all of those things. And we're going to pause in the story there because we don't have time to finish. Because I really believe that 4, 5, and 6 are incredibly instrumental in how we understand what happens later. And so I don't want to get too far. Next week we have a Valentine's banquet, so we have a 2-week break. So I want to kind of leave us with destruction, right? And then we'll come on judgment. And the Philistines have the ark and that. But I do want to take a moment, because I have a few minutes early here, to talk about the Ark of the Covenant. So the Ark had very strong Egyptian influence. And I don't know if we often realize that, because we don't think of the Hebrews or Israel as Egyptians, right? They were there, but they're not Egyptians. But the religious kind of mentality of the Egyptian pantheon, the gods, the culture, influenced the way that God gave instructions for the ark, right? God wouldn't take a holy relic from the Native American tribes and have the Hebrews build it. Because, they wouldn't understand the symbolism behind it. Right, God reveals himself to a people in their situation, that they can understand, right, in language and terms that they would know. Great example. So if I was in Kazakhstan somewhere, and I told someone this burger is almost as good as the food this place makes, and I show this slide, put that one up there for me. There's not a concept for it. Right? They're like, okay. Right? But that's the most American thing ever, by the way, that American flag flying by those golden arches. That's glorious. Yahweh's going to reveal himself to his people in a cultural context that they know, that they understand. And they've just spent 400 years in Egypt. They march out to this mountain on Sinai, and they're given instructions. All right, you can take the arcs down, the golden arches now. So let's talk a little bit about the Egyptian background, the function of the ark. So an ark is, and it rhymes with this. This is great. It's a type of sacred bark, right? So it's like a Dr. Seuss-like book, right? The ark, the bark, right? So it's a sacred kind of bark. And what the barks were Egyptian holy vessels, and they were meant to move the god from holy sacred spaces through profane spaces to other holy sacred spaces, right? So it was a way to create a holiness box, put them in it so they're not defiled, and get them through all the unholiness It's like going to let them back out in holiness space. That was kind of the concept behind it. And so the ark is designed to move God's presence from Sinai. Remember the holy mountain. The mountain's holy. Don't even touch it. Don't step foot on it. Right? The holy mountain, transport to eventually a holy mountain, Jerusalem. Right? That's the permanent dwelling where Yahweh will let his presence be in the temple. Now, there's times he fills the temple. We see the tabernacle. We see in the tent of glory with Moses. But those are all temporary manifestations until he gets to the temple on his holy mountain, right? So Sinai to Jerusalem. The most iconic element of the ark is what? What? When we think of the ark, what do we think of? The cherubim. That's right. Colin, throw that next slide up. Please. Thank you. You see the angels with the wings set out. Now, the Egyptians did the same thing. They had goddesses with wings of a bird, and what they would do is they would cover what they thought was holy. So the next slide. This is hard to see because I had to take this picture on my textbook. Do you see on the corner you have the goddess, and you see her arms stretched to either side, and there's one of those on every corner of the box. So what they're doing is they're dedicating the space as holy space in this box, right? This is to move what is to, you know, through what is from what is sacred to what is not. Think about Noah's Ark. Chaos, water, decreation, keeping what is holy, holy. Noah, who is righteous, right? And getting him back to a mountain and dropping him off. Right. So you see this imagery is consistent. Like all the way through. All right, so the wings covered what was holy. For most gods, their holiness was contained in the box, right? They put the lid on it, they'd have the space in there, and that was where the god could go and be safe. But the Ark of the Covenant had the cherubim at the top of the ark, right? And there's the, you can see some imagery there of God's not contained in the box, right? It's still a holy space, but it's actually out in the open, which is interesting. Now, we're going to come back, so put a pin in that, and we're going to come back to the second purpose of the ark as a sacred palanquin, is how you say that, sacred palanquin, which was a throne. And the uniqueness of the ark is that it takes the sacred bark, and it takes the Egyptian palanquin, and it puts them together into one figure, one entity, right? And so you have this throne-like setup called the mercy seat, and then that's the holiest place, actually on top of the ark between the wings of the cherubim. And this is where a king would sit for godlike status, these palanquins. I think I have a picture of a chair. Put that up there. So see this chair they would sit on. And now, if you can see it, do you see in the left corner where the arm goes up, do you see what comes down? You see the wings? Can you see those in there? It's kind of hard to see. But they come down behind the head of the lion on the left, and they come out along the armrest. There's one on both sides. Again, the wings designating the holy space where the king would sit, right? And it's like godlike status. And a lot of these would be put in tombs. So when a pharaoh would die, they would put these palanquins in the tomb with them to be carried off in the afterlife, and they'd sit in this holy godlike seat because they were deity in that sense and be carried off by their servants. So they take this kind of palanquin thing and they combine it with the ark, the bark, you know. And the question is, what is the dual imagery from Egypt, the bark and the palanquin, what does it communicate? What's being communicated as Israel is making this thing? I think the first thing you say is that Yahweh is not contained, right? Like he doesn't go in the box. And then when you get to the temple, you get to decide to let him out of the box. Like that's not, right? He rides on top of the box. His holy space is above the box, okay? But it also says this. It also says that if he rides outside of the ark, it says that in transition from point A to point B, he can't be defiled by the profane. He's not worried about it. So he is so holy that the profane can't contaminate. You see, I think we see this with Christ, right? What happens when the bleeding woman touches him? healed. What happens to the lepers? He touches lepers. They're healed, right? Like their uncleanliness, profaneness can't contaminate his holiness. See, so the ark kind of symbolizes God rides on top in the open. He's not profaned. He can't be. He's holier than that, right? That's kind of a unique concept for what this would be. I mean, the best way for us to explain it would be if we're going from here to Mars and we get in a spaceship, we don't want to ride outside the spaceship, right? Like we can't hack it. We need to be inside the spaceship until we get to the base on Mars. Then we can get out, right? Yahweh doesn't need that. He can ride in the profane. It's fine. Okay? He's not profane, right? He can't be contained. Second, he's not profaned. And then we can ask, you remember what was in the ark? 10 commandments. Aaron's rod. The manna. Yeah. And for a while, maybe bones of Joseph or something at some point might have gone through with them, but that was a pretty temporary thing. Manna. Yeah, those are the three things we think of, right, in the ark. Okay. I think this is going to be really cool, I think. All right, so the ark represents, I got a big dramatic board flip. I wrote in my notes, flip the board dramatically and take a sip of tea. So I'm going to do it when we get there. It's really good. It's really good. If it's really bad, just pretend like it's really good because I've thought this out. All right, so the ark represents Yahweh's presence, but it's different from other barks because the holiest space, as identified with the cherubim's wings, was on the mercy seat, okay, outside the ark, on top of the ark, meaning in between Sinai and Jerusalem, that place cannot profane his holiness. He's too holy for that, all right? Inside the ark, tablets of law, manna, Aaron's staff. The law, the kingship, the tablets were what the greater king would give to the lesser king, right? So kingship is represented in tablets, right? Suzerain, vassal. Manna, Moses, this is why Jesus is constantly turning, like multiplying bread and feeding multitudes. He's doing Moses type of actions. And then Aaron, priesthood. So we have kingship, we have the greatest prophet, and we have, up to this point, and then we have the priesthood represented in the ark. Okay, I think you guys know the answer to this one. What figure in the Bible has perfectly kept the law, fulfilled Moses, and is the great high priest? You guys, this is great. Okay, right. And in no way tainted by uncleanliness, right? So you see those things. All right, remember John 20, 11 through 12. It's all the big flip's coming. It's coming, guys. We're so close. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb, and as she stooped to look into the tomb, she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head, one at the feet. You ready? Here we go. It's the mercy seat. This would have been a lot cooler if I flipped it, checked it before the... Okay. What Mary looks in on is the angels sitting over the tomb of Jesus. And this is how they would have had this raised up concrete thing, they'd have laid the body in it, and then it come back and done the burial, all kind of stuff. It's the mercy seat. So the resurrection, you have the mercy seat. And the angels, sitting there representing the angels from the ark. So I think you can make the argument that the ark was this kind of typological foreshadow of Christ. It was. Its function, its purpose, God's presence with his people. What is Jesus? Emmanuel. God with us, right? Dwelling, walking with his people, not tainted by unholiness, fulfilling all the aspects, prophet, priest, king. He's the great judge. And in the end, you see the mercy seat. It's pretty cool, right? I thought that was cool. Okay. And I think that the imagery, too, of the cherubim, specifically, is actually really helpful in dating the Exodus. And here's why. Winged figures in the Egyptian religious, iconography and all the hieroglyphics and stuff like that, they first come on the scene during the reign of Amenhotep III, on barks starting around 1389 BC. Their last scene on Egyptian iconography on the Egyptian palanquins during the reign of Ramses II, which ended in 1073. So what this means is that the most conservative date for the Exodus is about 1250, sometime in there. So right in the middle of when the winged goddesses on all of the artwork showed up, we have both of the two figures they appeared on in one element, and they don't appear after it, they don't appear before it. So when it comes to dating the Exodus, it really gives us a really good idea when the Exodus happened. It happened sometime between 1389 and 1073. Now, if David was king in 1000 AD, 73 years is not enough to go back it up a little bit, right? So 1250 tends to be the standard kind of convincing thing there, but the winged figures help us also kind of lock down when we think the Exodus happened. So when the temple's built, Yahweh has his permanent Holy of Holies. The ark's function is actually complete as a presence carrier, right? It's still a ritual implement, right? The mercy seat, the high priest would still go in. He would do certain things in there, the sprinkle of the blood, right? You have all that. But it was rituals of day of atonement and no longer a place that God would sit and dwell, right? He had the Holy of Holies. And if you remember in the exile, the ark's carried away. It's probably melted down by Nebuchadnezzar to pay his troops. But after the permanent temple was built, the ark had cultic relevance, but no longer held God's presence. There's no need for it. It's no different than a bowl or a censer or something else that was used for the worship of the Lord. Jeremiah 3:16 says this. It says, when you've multiplied and been fruitful in the land, in those days, declare the Lord, they shall say no more the ark of the covenant of the Lord. It shall not come to mind or be remembered or missed. It shall not be made again. Jeremiah seems to make the argument there's one ark. It serves the purpose. No need for it ever again. And then I think you get to where, so you have God made flesh. You have Jesus, who does all the things the ark was supposed to do, but imperfectly. He does it perfectly. He fulfills the whole function of the ark. There is no need for an ark. Christ has done it. This is the mercy. It's done. So there's no need for us to hope that an ark is built. Like, right, we don't, like, none of this, dare I say, matters, because Christ has done it. And so, and Jeremiah says, it's not going to happen again. Now, I'm not saying, look, somewhere, I think it's in Texas, there's a guy who has a replica ark he built, right? I'm not saying no one could put an ark-looking thing together, but there will be no more ark with God's presence dwelling in it. It's done. It's a shadow of something better, right? So, any thoughts or questions? There's one last thing. Chronicles 2, 35-3. This is Josiah during his reign, right before he ends. He says to the Levites, who taught all Israel and who were holy to the Lord, put the holy ark in the house that Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, built. You do not carry it on your shoulder. Need not carry it on your shoulders. Now serve the Lord your God and his people Israel. So as things are kind of crashing in, we know the ark is still in Jerusalem at that point. Josiah hasn't moved. So it kind of takes away from the first sacking. It had been carried off to Ethiopia or Egypt or something like that. Odds are, once God's presence is off of it, it's no longer a holy instrument to the touch, right? I mean, it's that kind of idea, like, God can choose to touch you. Don't you dare reach out and try to touch him, right? And there's a sense, like, the king can choose to talk to you. You don't presume upon the king. The presence of God can choose to go into the profane. You don't bring the profane into him, which is, you don't put any gods before me in my temple, right? You don't bring the profane into the holiness, which is why Uzziah, when he reaches up and touches the ark, keep it from falling. It's being transported the wrong way. He's from Judah. He shouldn't even been there in the first place. The Levites in their job, right? He wouldn't have been anywhere near it. It wouldn't have toppled over. Oh, and by the way, you weren't invited to touch the presence of the Lord. How dare you? Right? So you see kind of how all these things come together in one. So I thought some time on the ark was important because we're going to go into them carrying the ark into war. The ark is going to go in the temple of Dagon. It's going to do all this kind of stuff coming up. So I wanted to spend a little time on that as well. If you want more, if you just can't get enough of your ark reading, I've got them for you right here. You're welcome to read all the ancient Egypt stuff you want, and the Ark of the Covenant in its Egyptian context. Yeah, that's right. I didn't figure that was going to be a hot topic for anyone to grab, but the offer is there.